Hello, my name is Chet, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to WackyPaw 15 in Las Vegas. WackyPaw is the Western Area Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. Please help me open this meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The topic of this panel meeting is Do the Steps or Die. And I have now asked Tom R. to read a passage from AA literature related to the topic.
Hello, my name's Tom, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
This reading is from the Big Book, Bill's Story, pages 14 through 15. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how apparently true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through the work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. This reading is from the Big Book, Bill's Story, page 16. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variably strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life.
Thank you, Tom. And now I would like to welcome our first speaker, Pat O. from Orange County, California.
Hi, my name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic.
Pat.
And I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be here. And grateful for all my friends that came and supported me. And, I'm really grateful to be sober today. You know, I'm just sitting here and I look at the topic. It's like, do the steps or die. You know, it's good. You know, I'm like, where's the AA love in that, you know? At the Alano Club I go to, there's a sign on the wall that says, we care, you know. And, you know, I'll tell you, when I got sober on October 23rd, 2002, I was at an indigent detox in Costa Mesa. It was called Charlie Street. And they cared. And the way they told me that they cared, they said, you're sick. We don't want what you have. They said, you know, if you want what we have, then you'll do what we do. And they told me to sit down, shut up. You know, this is the most profound words I'd heard in a long time, you know. And my sponsor was a Big Book guy. You know, he was a big book guy. He believed in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He sat down, he read word for word and line for line out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was this other book that was on the table, and I asked him what it was. He said, it's a dictionary. And he said, I'm sure you're not going to know all the words, so why don't you look up the words that you don't know and look the definitions up. And, you know, and I, you know, thinking about the topic and thinking about how it was for me when I got sober, you know, that's how it was. It was like, do this stuff or you can leave. Like, I don't want you to waste my time is what he told me. He said, if you're going to waste my time, then you need to find a new sponsor. And I'll tell you, like, I didn't know if I was wasting his time or not. I was kind of clueless. You know what I mean? I was like, huh? And I was sitting at this Charlie Street and they told me that he told me that he's like, this chair right here, he's like, this is your seat. You never have to leave it if you don't want to. And later that night, I was, you know, went to my little room where I was sleeping, and some guy was in my chair. I'm like, hey, dude, you got to get up, you know. And I didn't know what he meant at the time, you know. But I paid a big price for the chair that I sit in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And my first drink of alcohol is 9 years old. I was at an AA meeting of all places. My mom got sober when I was 11 months old, and I grew up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was an AA kid. You know, I saw a little baby in the meeting last night, you know, and I was 11 months old and I came to AA, and I came to conferences when I was a little kid, and, you know, I'd hang out with you guys, you know, and the women in AA took care of me. You know, the women in AA would take me for the weekend. You know, they would, I met some of these women today, you know, since I've been sober, you know, and they're like, your mom would let me take you when I had 7 days, you know. And, you know, I know a lot of you guys, you know, I wouldn't let my five-year-old go with you guys, you know, but, you know, maybe AA was different 30 years ago. I don't know, but, you know, I grew up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw what alcoholism did. You know, I could recite chapter 5 in the meetings. I could recite the 12 traditions. At the end of the meeting, I was like, keep coming back, you know, and my mom would bring women home, and they'd detox on the couch, and I saw what alcoholism did. You know, and if love and knowledge had anything to do with alcoholism, I'd have never taken my first drink. But at 9 years old, I was at an AA meeting with these other kids. Their single parents brought them to AA. And these kids pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo. And I didn't know what alcohol was going to do to me or for me. But I'll tell you what I knew that day. If I didn't drink it, I wasn't going to be like. That got really loud. And I took my first drink of alcohol because I wanted to be accepted by these kids. You know, my whole life as a kid, you know, I it's really loud now. And I suffered from alcoholism long before I took my first drink, you know. And the best way I can talk about the spiritual malady for me is you know, my mom would put me in baseball. Like, I was like the kid in right field, you know. There's some right fielders, you know. You know, the kid in right field's like, you know what I mean, like looking around. You know what I mean? I'm like excited because there's like a long piece of grass with some white thing growing on it. You know what I mean? I'm like walking off to get the grass, you know. I mean, the game's going on, you know, and I'm clueless. You know what I mean? And that's me. You know, I mean, I remember one day I was on second base, and I don't know how I got there, you know, because I'm on second base, like, what do I do, you know? And all of a sudden, this kid cracked it, bam, and I ran back to first base, you know, and it was a triple play, you know what I mean? And I remember putting my head down like this, you know what I mean? Oh my God, shame and guilt, you know. Here, once again, I let somebody down, you know. And I remember looking in the stands, and my mom was there, you know. And my mom's like, oh my God, clapping for me. She's like, my son, you know. And she wasn't proud that her son got a triple play. She was proud that her son was playing baseball. And I remember sitting there that day looking at my mom saying, if I only had a dad, my life would be different. If I only had a dad teaching me how to play baseball, that would never happen. You know, and I was so disconnected as a kid, you know. Like, I always wondered what it would be like to play catch with my father. You know, and I'd go to school, and I didn't feel a part of. I felt less than, because I knew all of you guys had a dad. And I remember that day saying that to myself, you know. And at 9 years old, I took a drink of alcohol to be connected with those three or four kids that day. And I remember the bottle going around. I took a pull off that bottle. I didn't like the taste, and I spit it out. And what happened for me, I was overcome with fear. And what that fear was that I wasn't going to be like the rest of my life. It didn't matter if those three or four kids, that way was going to be that way forever. And I remember that bottle going around. I took a pull off that bottle, and I held it down. And what happened for me was I connected with those three kids that day. And all of a sudden, I was the littlest guy, and they're like, oh, yeah, getting the little guy drunk, you know. And I equated that alcohol was going to connect me to the world, you know. And I went about my life, and I got kicked out of my house at 17, at 27 when I got sober. You know, I hadn't showered in 6 months. I was 98 pounds. I was up for roughly like 20 days. I hadn't eaten for, you know, 14 days. I was on 6 in Los Angeles, downtown LA. I had 2 shoes, only one had a sole. And I stood in the corner and went, and I thought I was an antenna. I thought the aliens were communicating through me to get important information from the human race, you know. And I would see the devil and his troops. They'd follow me wherever I went. I heard voices in my head, and I was just absolutely crazy. You know, and I've been back to Skid Row many times since I've gotten sober. You know, and I see guys just like me. And it was a normal way to live. You know, I wasn't living any different than the guy I was hanging out with. You know, I'd gone to rehab. I went to Betty Ford, and Betty Ford was a good place. It gave me a lot of education. And they told me I couldn't fraternize, you know, so I met this girl there. Well, we didn't really meet. I wrote her a note, you know, and I passed it to her, and she passed me a note. And 28 days later, we fell in love, you know. I mean, my counselor brought me in. He wanted me to do step one. I'm like, oh, I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol. Life's unmanageable. You know, because I knew the steps by heart when I was a little kid. And then step two, he wanted me to come to believe, you know. And I was believing, all right, right in this girl. You know what I mean? And I swear it was God's will. I mean, Because I wrote her a note. I'm like, I got to do a nine-month program. She's like, so do I. You know what I mean? I'm like, dude, the stars are aligning here, you know? And so I asked her where she wanted to move to. She's like, let's go to Hawaii. You know what I mean? I was like, rad, romance too, you know? And I felt that I could become one with the ocean, and you know what I mean? But this was the answer, you know? And I was most likely to succeed guy, you know what I mean? If anyone has been to treatment, you know who that guy is. I was like the co-counselor, you know? And I got on the plane, and the stewardess asked me what I wanted to drink. And if you're a heroin addict and you're not an alcoholic, a Heineken sounds just about right, you know? And I remember the stewardess brought me a Heineken, and 12 or 13 Heinekens later, I landed in Hawaii. And I was standing there, and it was like sober living or the bar. You know, sober living or the bar. And I sat there, and I thought about it. And there's a line in our big book that says to live by spiritual principles or die an alcoholic death, something paraphrasing. And it says something to the effect that this isn't always an easy choice for us. And I stood there that day thinking about it, not knowing that I took the first drink and lost the power of choice, right? Not knowing about the phenomenon of craving, not knowing about the mental obsession. I went in and out of AA for a long time, and I'd say, my name is Pat, I'm an addict. And so, you know, get the addict out of the room, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? I would leave AA, F you guys, slam the door, you know, and I'd come back to AA and I'm an addict, get the dirty, you know. In my experience, I'm sure it's different in Las Vegas, but no one ever followed me out the door and said, hey, here's a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you might suffer from alcoholism and not know what alcoholism is. You know, no one ever sat down, no one ever followed me out. And so I'd come back to AA to get the heat off, you know, and I'd hear people, you know, I'd hear, listen. And so I'd say, oh, I'm Pat, I'm an alcoholic and an addict, because I'm looking for the loophole. And then someone would go, $2, you know, I was, oh, man, screw you guys, you know, I'm at AA, and I'd leave, you know. And no one ever followed me out talking about alcoholism. And when I took that drink, it took me another 2 years so I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in the condition I told you I was in. And on the last plan and idea I had, I taught my mom how to Western Union money. She had gone to Al-Anon. For an alcoholic, that sucks, you know, because the money stops coming in, you know what I mean? And so I was looking at a nine month Salvation Army program or go to jail. And I was in and out of jail. And so I manipulated my mom to get me this motel. I called some friends. I got some things I needed. I stole a 30 pack of beer and I went up in there to kill myself. And I went for the first attempt. My heart went out and I came to, and I was full of anger, you know, and I was angry because I couldn't kill myself, right? And I went for the second attempt, and my heart went out, and I came to, and these two goofy guys from AA came and got me. And they took me to Charlie Street. This guy took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did an inventory. When I did that fourth step, I came to find out that I was selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, and dishonest in every relationship in my life, and that I was driven by fear. You know, and AA, around here, like, we fall in love, you know? And I met this girl, and we had a kid. Well, back up before the kid. I broke up with her because I got afraid. I don't know how you guys are, but when I get afraid, like, I look outward. You know what I mean? I'm in a relationship, but I'm looking outward. And I'm flirting with other girls in AA, right? The spiritual guy. You know, coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, putting this front on that I'm doing a great job in AA and I'm really spiritual. And so I broke up with her. And slept with her friend. And then we started hooking back up, and she got pregnant. And she decided to keep the kid. And I'm talking to my sponsor, and he said, you're going to do whatever it takes to make this relationship right. And I went to therapy every week. And I sat there for, I don't know, 9 months plus 6 months and hashed that thing out every week. And that relationship didn't work, And I went into a depression. I mean, serious depression. I'd go to work. It's kind of like, and I'd go to my AA meeting because my feet were trained. Right? My feet were trained in Alcoholics Anonymous. Show up to the meeting, stand in the greeting line. At the end of the meeting, you stack chairs. After you stack chairs, you mop, you sweep, you put your hand out, you say, hi, my name is Pat, I'm an alcoholic. And all of a sudden, I got like 8 sponsees. You know what I mean? I don't know what I had that they wanted, but. Because I'd go home and I'd just sleep, right? And I'd go to my lunch break, I'd go home and I'd sleep. And after work, I'd go sleep. And then I'd go to the meeting. And it took me about 9 months to do an inventory. And I remember doing that inventory, and I remember doing a fist step with my sponsor. My sponsor said, "What's your biggest fear?" I said, "Well, my biggest fear is that I'm afraid to be alone." And he said, "The underlying fear is that you're afraid to die alone." I was like, "Dude, easy, bro," you know. And I was kind of sitting there, and I was kind of put back a little bit. And he said, "The real fear is that you're afraid that there really is no God." And I absolutely just started crying. And my sponsor put his hands around me, and he calls me son, and he said, "Son, it's going to be okay." He said, "What I want you to do is I want you to go every day. I want you to pray and say, 'God, I don't believe that you exist. Will you please show me?'" And so every day I'm on my knees, "God, I don't believe that you exist. Will you please show me? God, I don't believe that you exist. Will you please show me?" And all of a sudden I got a call because of the ninth step. Right? I was dating this girl for 10 years when we were getting loaded, and I made an amends to her. And she called me and she said, "Pat, I just found my sister hung from the rafters." She said, "Will you please help me?" I'm not no magic man, you know what I mean? But the words that came out of my mouth said, "Yes, I'll be there." Right? Because Alcoholics Anonymous trained me to say yes to anything that I'm asked to do around here. How can I be of service? What can I do to help you? And I just said yes. And I went to her house and I was being of service and I'm cleaning up and I'm going grocery shopping and I'm putting things away for the family. And all of a sudden we got to a place where there was really nothing else I could do. And I went in the backyard and I started praying to a God that I didn't believe in. Because Alcoholics Anonymous trained me. My sponsor always told me, "Pray even though you don't believe. Get on your knees and just pray. Take the action." And at 7 years of sobriety, I'm sitting in the backyard praying to a God I don't believe in. Forgot that I said this prayer. And all of a sudden, this hummingbird fell right in front of my face. It was like, "Bloo," you know what I mean? I was like, oh my God, I get it, you know? And I called my sponsor, and I'm like, "Sponsor, like, I get it, like this hummingbird." He's like, "Cool, you know?" And my sponsor doesn't tell me what to do. He's a sounding board for my own voice. And what came out of my mouth was that I said, "I believe that there is a God, but I don't believe that I'm worth God's love." And my sponsor said, "I want you to do every day is I want you to pray, 'God, I believe that you exist, but I don't believe that I'm worth your love.'" Every day I'm on my knees, right? "Oh, God, I believe that you exist, but I don't believe that I'm worth your love." And this is going on. I'm taking the action, you know, and I'm in this training, and we're in a circle, and all of a sudden this guy's asking about fear, and the lady's talking about fear, and she's talking about the deer in the headlights, and this little lizard goes across the circle, stands and freezes, right? And the lady in the training says, "You see that lizard?" And I'm like, "Yeah." We all are like, "Yeah, we see a lizard." And she says, "That's fear, right? That paralyzing, stuck feeling." And I get that feeling, and I understand that paralyzing fear. And I usually react when I get in that space. And I'm sitting there in the training. All of a sudden, my friend's hitting me, and she's pointing out my leg. And I look down, and this little lizard walks up my leg. And it walks in my lap, and I look down at it, and it looks at me, and it kind of just puts its head down and closes its eyes. And I thought that if that little lizard trusted me, that God, maybe God loved me this much. Then I was like, "Get off my lap," you know what I mean? And the lizard took off, and it started a little bit of a journey about this idea of God. See, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't come to believe in God. I'd sit on Skid Row, and I'd sit there, and I'd see the devil and his troops, and I'd have full-on conversations with the devil, and he'd tell me what to do, and he'd tell me to go rob this person and rob that person. And I'd done a lot of bad things to a lot of people to get just one more hit. And so I came to believe that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous weren't lying to me. I came to believe in this sponsor. I made a decision to do whatever my sponsor told me to do. And at 7 years of sobriety, the truth of the matter was that I didn't believe in God. And at 7 years of sobriety, I started to believe in some sort of a God, you know. And if you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I mean, like, just do what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I did. Was I went to these stupid AA potlucks. I hated AA potlucks, you know what I mean? Because you had to talk to people, you know what I'm saying? And I'd sit there and I'd just be absolutely like, just like, you know what I mean? And someone would be like, "Hi, I'm Chet," you know? And I was like, "Hi, Chet," you know? Because I'm that kid in right field, you know? And I would take off, and then I'd be at another meeting, and Matt would say, "Hey, Matt, I'm Pat. You know, come to this young people's thing." And I'm like, "Yeah, that's what I want to do." Not really. You know, and all of a sudden I'm just jumping in the car and I'm getting to young people's, you know, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, we're so," you know, this excitement, you know, and I'm like in the corner just like, you know. And all of a sudden I go to another young people's thing, you know, and I'm like, "Hey, Matt, how you doing?" You know, Matt's like, "Oh, my family," or whatever. And then I see him at another meeting. And I'm like, "Hey, how's the family?" Like, I really care. But all of a sudden, I started to care about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I have a little five-year-old son. And I love that kid more than anything else. You know, and if you're my friend on Facebook, there's thousands of pictures of this little kid. And I went and spoke at a camp out in Annie Paul, which is like 10 hours north of my house, you know. And I have a little four. He's four at the time. And if you ever drive that far with a four-year-old, it's like really, it gets on your nerves. I mean, he wants to know what this tractor is. I'm like, "I told you what the tractor was an hour ago." You know what I mean? I mean, 8 hours in, he wants to know, "Hey, what's that?" I'm like, "I told you that an hour ago." And like, you're getting on my nerves. I'm starting to get restless, irritable, and discontent. You know what I mean? I got to go to Walmart to get some ice, and I got the wrong thing. Or I'm just getting more frustrated, more frustrated, more frustrated. And I'm starting to be frustrated at him and starting to snap, and I'm starting to get, upset. And I love this kid more than anything else. And I get out of the camp out, and all of a sudden I get attacked by like 50 mosquitoes, you know what I mean? And I'm just having a bad day. And I go to bed that night. I set up the tent. I go to bed that night, and I review my day. Because Alcoholics Anonymous trained me what to do. And I'm reviewing my day, and I'm praying to this God, right? And I'm like, "God, like, I don't appreciate the way I treated my kid, and I'm asking for some sort of forgiveness, and I'm asking for you to guide me and direct me in a way that you want me to be, you want me to move." And all of a sudden, what came to me was that I need to make amends to that four-year-old little boy. And that next morning, I woke up, and his name's Eden. And for all you acronym people, his name is Eden Gannon Ochoa. And I said, "Eden," I said, "Would you like to go on a walk with your dad?" I said, "I need to talk to you about a few things." He said, "Sure, Dad," you know. So me and him are taking a walk, and we go up this trail, and I get down on my knee, and I look, you know, because I like to look at my level. I like to be an equal to him. I'm no better than him. I'm no less. I'm just equal to him. And I said, "Eden," I said, "I treated you in a way yesterday that I don't appreciate treating anybody. I treated you out of frustration and anger. And I said, I just want to make amends to you. I want to tell you that I'm sorry, and I won't do that again today. You know, because I can take care of my actions today. I don't know what I'm going to be like tomorrow, but I said, just for today, I'm not going to treat you that way." And he looked at me and he said, "Dad," he said, "everyone makes mistakes." He says, "It's okay. I don't know how I can get from Skid Row on 6 in Los Angeles to a place right there with unconditional love, except through the process of the 12 steps. I took the 12 steps and my attitude and my perception to life changed. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you."
Thank you, Pat. Now I would like to welcome our next speaker, Lee F. from Los Angeles, California.
Woo!
Thank you, Lee.
Hi, I'm Lee. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lee. Hi, Lee.
Thank you so much for your share. I met your mom when I had 5 years sober. She's pretty cool. So I was thinking about do the steps or die, and I thought, holy shit, that doesn't leave a lot of gray area. But, you know, I started thinking, it's so true, because, you know, even though in my sobriety I've had so much fun, I mean, I had fun out there too, but I had so much fun, you know, since I've been kind of on this long pink cloud for a while, and I forget sometimes that it's a progressive disease and that it will kill me because I have so much fun. You know, I haven't looked back and gone, how many days have sucked since I've gotten sober? Because most of them are really good. And even the ones that aren't so good still aren't that bad. And, you know, I have almost 12 years in March. I'll have 12, so I'm really excited about that. And thank you. I am grateful for Jay for asking me to come. And, you know, when you have commitments, you make friends. That's what I've experienced in sobriety. I have commitments at pretty much every meeting I go to, and at the beginning it was like 7 meetings, and I had commitments at every meeting. And, you know, now I have commitments at all the meetings I go to still. And one of them is still the same meeting that I met Jay at 12 years ago. Well, 10, because you have 10. And, you know, grateful to be, I never thought, I guess when I started drinking between 6th and 7th grade, I don't know how old you are then, but between 6th and 7th grade, I never thought in a million years that I'd be standing here saying, I am grateful to be sober and at a meeting. That just didn't, you know, cross my mind when I was stealing booze out of my grandpa's stash. But do the steps or die, it's an unbelievable topic, and I'm grateful to be alive is really the truth, because, you know, I was 28 when I got sober, and, you know, from 6th grade to 28 is a long time, and you can, there's a lot of damage between that age and 28. And, you know, it's funny, my first sponsor, you know, I got up to step 4, and honestly, I was not really doing the work. I was just sort of winging it. And I didn't really want to be sober. I kind of did, but I kind of didn't. And, you know, I thought my bottom wasn't that bad, and it's not that bad, and I was wrong. But my first sponsor, I got up to step 4, half-assed, you know, half measures avail me nothing. And she was younger than me, and she had, you know, sort of assigned herself to be my sponsor. And when I got up to step 4 and I was reading, you know, my half-assed inventory, she was like, oh, I did that, and I did that, and I did that, and I did that. And I was like, shut the fuck up. This is about me. And then I relapsed. I mean, I wasn't doing the work, clearly. And, you know, it took me, like, not too long to get back, because I knew I needed to be here, but I didn't do the steps the way they were supposed to be done, which was honestly and rigorous honesty. I didn't have it. That wasn't my makeup. And so I had to, you know, the second time I did the 4-step, I was so honest, I got violently ill. Like, I had to go home, and, you know, you go home and you do your 6 and 7 step, and I was sick. I couldn't even do my 6 and 7 step. I was throwing up. I was sick. But it was almost like a cleansing. I know that sounds weird, and I don't have an eating disorder, but it just felt so weird, you know, and then I had to go to sleep. But since then, you know, I've done, you know, other 4 steps since then, but I really was thorough, and I really did it, and I was so happy to have gotten rid of so much of that stuff from, you know, 28 years prior. So I was really lucky. But what she said to me, which was really important, and, you know, she's still my sponsor today, what she said to me was, you know, and I carried this for years, and she said, you are not an alcoholic because your mom left when you were 4 days old. She's homeless. You grew up with your grandparents. You have no real brothers and sisters, but you have aunts and uncles that you grew up with, and they're, most of them are alcoholics, and that, you know, hereditary, yes, but she said none of those reasons make you an alcoholic. She said you are bodily and mentally different from your fellows. And I thought, really? Because everybody I hang out with is just like me. So I didn't get that. And, you know, and then I realized that mainly I was hanging around with people like me who were drinking and using like me. And, you know, lower companions, they talk about that. I was one of them. I was with them and one of them. And so it didn't make sense. But it took me a little bit to understand what she was saying. Because just because that was my history growing up, and it was acceptable to drink and use when you were in 6th and 7th grade, I mean, my grandparents didn't exactly know that I was doing it, but, you know, my brothers and sisters did. My oldest uncle was a cocaine, and is still a cocaine dealer. He's 53 years old, and he was my dealer, and everything was free. I mean, how do you say no to free? And, you know, he did give me one warning, though, when I was, I don't know, 7th grade or something. It was the summer between 7th and 8th grade. He said to me, well, you know, now that you can handle your alcohol, because now he's buying alcohol for me, I don't have to steal it anymore, I'm going to let you try cocaine. And what I want you to know is that you shouldn't hang around with the boys when you do cocaine. And I was like, well, why? And he said, because the boys get frisky on cocaine. And I thought, so what's going to happen to me? And, you know, believe it or not, I listened to him, which is the weird part. And when I did cocaine, I only hung out with girls because I was, like, weirded out by what he said. So I never really went in that direction. But what's funny is when I got sober, you know, I got sober with a bunch of great girls in L.A. And a lot of them have like, I was a stripper, I was a hooker, I was this, I was that. And I'm like, did I miss out on something? Because like that never happened to me. And, you know, there would be times that, you know, my girlfriends would be going to hook up with people and I'd be in a fist fight with the bartender. Like that was my thing. I didn't want to kiss you or make out with you or have sex with you. I wanted to beat you up. And, you know, I had a violent past, and, you know, I can't say that it's gotten all that great in sobriety. I've had a few incidences. You know, it's not my past that makes me who I am. It's where I'm going now in sobriety that makes me who I am. And I would not have known that if it wasn't for amazing people in my life. You know, through the beginning of sobriety when I was on that pink cloud, and, you know, after I realized this really isn't about me, it's about being of service and helping the next alcoholic achieve sobriety, when I realized it wasn't about me, after I had done my steps and cleaned my shit up and done my ninth step and continue to do a 10 step when I do something stupid and I know I'm doing it, I can go, oh, God, there's going to be an amends for that one, you know, or I try and stop it before it actually happens. You know, rage is definitely one of my character defects that I work on every single day. And, you know, I can't say that it's gone, but I can say that it's you know, at bay when I'm working the steps, showing up, doing my commitments. You know, and I have sponsees, and I think, how the hell do they want what I have? But I have sponsees that we go through the book, and we go through the steps, and we read all the pages. We don't skip, you know, and I don't say, you're better now, you don't have to work any more steps, or you don't have to sponsor anybody. You know, we do that, and that's part of, you know, me staying clean and sober. That helps me. And I speak when people ask me to speak, and I go to places far away when people ask me to show up. And I guess that's the grace of God in my life, you know, because I didn't think that that was ever going to happen. I mean, I grew up in the projects in South Boston, and there was not a lot of, you know, there was the Catholic God that if you didn't go to church, he punished you. And, you know, if you didn't go to church, my grandparents punished me. But it was, you know, sneak in the back, grab a little wine, grab the flyer, and tell them you went to church. That was enough for me. And, you know, my brothers and sisters, which are my aunts and uncles, they were all drinking, and I thought it was acceptable. And nobody went to AA. Nobody got sober. And, you know, now I live in California, and I'm the only sober person in my family. And it's, you know, we have one normie, and I think she's adopted, because it's like... She went to school, she went to college, she got engaged, she got married, she had kids, she bought a house. I'm like, that is so normal, I don't know who you are. And, you know, growing up, I thought she was the biggest nerd, and I never wanted to hang out with her or talk to her, and I hung out with all my other brothers and sisters who were drunks like me. And now, today, she's my favorite sister. I know that's awful to say, but true. So she's my favorite sister, and I fly her out to California every year to take a cake at my home group on Sunday morning. And she's unbelievably supportive, and she's completely normal. It's so strange. And her kids are normal, and, you know, they're 17 and 15, and they're not doing the shit I was doing when I was that age. And I look and I think, how does that happen? You know, how does something like that happen? And she forgave me for all the stuff I did to her. I mean, I really did some doozies on that poor girl growing up, and she's forgiven me. Because now today I can be the sister and the aunt that she wants me to be and that I want to be. And, you know, I was heavy into my addiction when I was 20, and that's when my Nana died. And, you know, I only knew my Nana as my mom. She was the only, you know, person in my life that was my mom. And she died. And I didn't want to be around anymore. And I thought, I'm going to, you know, I'm done. And believe it or not, my brother was my supplier, and he was not willing to give me any cocaine because I swear he could see it in my eyes. I mean, I was done. I was going to do all, as much as I could till my heart stopped. That was my intention, and he wouldn't give me any. And then I started searching around other places, and because I was so used to getting it from him, I didn't know where else to go. And believe it or not, I didn't die. I did have a fist fight and end up in jail, but I did not die, which was good. You know, and I think of, what if that did happen? What if I did, you know? There's a lot of things I've done in the last 12 years that I am so grateful and proud of, that I would have missed out on that whole experience. And I think then was when I started believing that there's a difference between the Catholic higher power I grew up with, the Catholic God that I grew up with, and a higher power. You know, and I'm still technically Catholic, and I believe in God, but I also believe in higher power, which is a little bit different than you know, if I go to church and I do that whole thing. But you know, when I got sober, I was, you're really in that, I don't have a dad, you know, my grandpa's amazing. He's amazing. He's 90 years old, and I've taken him to Ireland every year for the last 10 years, and he's an amazing man, and I'm so lucky to have him. And, you know, but I was 4 years sober, and I started thinking, what am I, you know, I don't have a dad, you know, my mom's homeless, I haven't seen her in I don't know how long. And I went and I spoke at the Claire Foundation, which is in L.A., and it's for predominantly homeless people, and I had this smell of smoke and coffee, and I'm like, I've been here before. I've been here. And it was Super Bowl Sunday, and the Pats were playing, and I was like, I don't want to be here. And I had this, like, amazing sense that I remembered being in jail. So it made me think that I needed to go find my mother, and I did. When I was 4 years sober, I went back home to Boston, and I found her. I went to the homeless feeding that they have at lunchtime at the Harvard Square in Cambridge, and I had a picture of her when she was a little girl and at her first Holy Communion. And I was showing it around, and there was this person there who said that she knew her, and she had changed her name, and I said, well, can you take me to where she was? Now, at this point, I had no idea if this person was a man or a woman, and her name was Pat. Turned out she was a woman, but her name was Pat, which didn't help. And so we drive to this place that she tells me where my mother is, and we go down to this basement, which is not, it's like a three-story house, but there's a basement with nothing in it. And there's my mother. And it's like pot smoke everywhere, and I was like, can you come out here? I can't really go in there. And she came out, and she knew exactly who I was. And it was pretty amazing. And at the time, I worked at the House of Blues on Sunset, and she was wearing a House of Blues hat. It was just, you know, ironic. And, you know, I told her, I said, you know, I'm clean and sober for 4 years, and I just wanted to, you know, find you and maybe have some type of relationship with you. And so we went to Dunkin' Donuts, and she was hugging me and kissing me and telling everyone, this is my daughter. And it was very weird. But so we sat at Dunkin' Donuts, and I just asked her to tell me her story. And basically what happened was the feeling I had when I was at the Claire Foundation was she had been in jail the first 11 years of my life because she killed a guy. And so my Nana and Grandpa would take me there on the weekends, and they would have Alateen and Alitot meetings, and that's where I was. And I didn't even know that until I was at the Claire Foundation at 4 years of sobriety. And interestingly enough, she was a heroin addict, and that was the one thing I drew the line at. It was like, I don't care what else you give me, but I won't do heroin. And it was like I had that thing in my head that that was it. You know, well, I shouldn't say that. I wouldn't shoot heroin. If you gave me it in another format, that was fine. You know, I have a relationship with her today, which is tough because she writes at the level of a third grader, and she's still homeless. And, you know, I mail her to the Catholic Charities, which is a homeless, helps homeless people. I mail her, like, stamps and letters and phone cards, and she writes me. And, you know, I'm looking at her going, I don't look anything like this woman. I mean, she's like really short, has black hair, she has no front teeth, and she has fuck you tattooed on her knuckles. And I'm like, wow, we couldn't be any more different. But I have the same disease she has. The only difference is I got clean and sober, and she's still struggling. And so part of me stays here because I love my life today, and the other part of me thinks someday I might be that message for her, which could happen. But I'm so lucky to be here, and I'm so grateful to be sober, and thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Lee. Finally, please help me welcome our last speaker, Rob S. from Vancouver, BC.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Rob.
Hey, Rob.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Las Vegas, and I'd like to thank Anna and the advisory council for asking me to speak. I got sober on November the 5th, 1995, and I've been sober since. But that's not the first time I got sober. This time when I got sober, I was 20 years old. It was a month before my 21st birthday, and I'd previously gotten sober when I was 18. And I was going to meetings and stuff, and there was people talking about doing the steps, and I was like, that's not going to happen. And, you know, I continued to smoke PCP and drink vodka. And that combination with industrial solvents and glue took me to a bottom that I never knew existed. And when I was 18 and 19 years old, I was certified under the Mental Health Act of British Columbia as clinically insane, and I spent the better part of the next 2 years living in a psychiatric facility with electroshock treatment, straitjackets, and solitary confinement. And when I was in there, I got clean. I spent most of my time in solitary confinement, but they would let me out into the ward, and I was so screwed up that I would run around naked attacking the nurses, and they would put me back in solitary confinement where I felt like I belonged. So in it was about October 95 when I started going to meetings. But like I said, it was November 95, that was my clean date, and I started going to meetings inside the hospital, and I knew that the only way that I was going to have a better life is if I did the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to meetings. They started giving me day passes. People from the meetings started taking me outside to meetings in the suburbs. And some guys had seen me around, and they'd seen me changing, and they invited me into their closed men's step group where I started doing the steps immediately. And it wasn't shortly after that when I got discharged from the hospital on my 21st birthday, and I had a month of sobriety. Now, my drinking didn't start out that way. You know, it started out, you know, I had a wonderful upbringing with loving parents in the suburbs. And it just so happened that when I was 11 years old, we went to a family wedding. My cousin that was getting married was a Vancouver City policeman. I was asked to be an usher in the wedding party. All the rest of the groomsmen were also Vancouver City policemen. They got me drunk for the first time. And that was my introduction to alcohol. And shortly after that I got involved in punk rock, and then it evolved into street life, and started studying the teachings of Anton LaVey, started worshiping blood and fire, and it was just a downhill spiral from then until I got sober, right? Like, in the early years of my childhood, we used to go to church as a family, and my mom liked to show off, you know, how clean cut we were and everything. But, you know, some really horrible things happened to me when I was in Sunday school. And when I tell my sponsor, there are stories that make grown men cry. So when I got involved in the dark religions when I was a teenager, I really took my spirituality seriously. It wasn't until I got sober that, as a result of doing the steps and finding who I am as a real person without the facade of, you know, any machismo or arrogance or, you know what I mean, tattoos, spikes, and leather, without that, the 12 steps got me to know who I am as a real person. You know, as they say, uncovering the layers of the onion. They also say we were fearless and thorough from the very start. Now, what it doesn't say is that we were fearless and thorough for a little while or a little while longer. It says from the very start. Now, it's been my experience as a result of doing the steps that we continue doing the steps, and then when it gets down to step 12, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Do the steps, get the awakening. Every time we do the steps, we get a new awakening. Now, in my mid-20s, I got involved in service. I was a GSR of my home group, and then shortly after that, I became the DCM. And I was traveling all throughout the province of British Columbia, being a trusted servant of District 28, which was the Maine and Hastings war zone of downtown Vancouver. And I was 26 years old, and I was speaking. I was, you know, dressed up, suit and tie, speaking at service panel workshops and stuff. And, you know, that really gave me a sense of belonging and a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning in my life. Like, it was an amazing experience. The problem is that I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know if you've noticed by now, but I have, you know, an addictive personality. And, you know, everything I do, I take to the extreme. You know, and, you know, service is great, but the problem with that is that I got an ego when I did service. You know, I felt like somebody. And when I was 10 years sober, I started buying guns. And I felt really ashamed, and I didn't like talking about it at meetings because I felt like it was sort of like taboo or inappropriate, and that's because it is. It's just like, you know, one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. And then I started buying, you know, semi-automatic assault rifles and stopped going to meetings. Now, see, the thing is, okay. Now, see, the thing is that, you know, when we stopped going to church as a family, I started playing with matches, and that became my drug. And when I was starting fires and stuff when I was a kid, and when I started getting loaded and started, you know, living on the street and into punk rock and stuff, you know, it started, you know, our addictions progress. And the thing is that I got clean when I was pretty young, so, you know, I'm not a convicted felon. Now, the thing is that when I was in the hospital doing the steps in my closed men step group and in group therapy, when I was granted that privilege, what they taught me was to look back into your childhood and find things that brought you joy. And, that's what we should do to feel good about ourselves, to build our self-esteem, to build our confidence. Now, you know what? You know, I hate to admit it, but I'm a twisted guy. So what ended up happening was, I'd worked in steel fabrication shops when I was in my late teens. And then when I was in my early 20s, I put all the math together, and I decided that I could make a living melting steel with fire as an industrial welder. So what ended up happening was I became really good at it. And all throughout my 20s, I was obsessed with my career. And I did a lot of different things. You know, I work on motorcycles and I do all sorts of custom stuff on the side as a hobby. But what my career took me to is it took me to the oil fields in northern Alberta, where I became an oil and gas pressure welder. And, that's a real sensitive subject with some people because I'm an environmental terrorist, okay, in the eyes of some people. And the bottom line is that when I was on the street, I was not from the school of the anarcho-peace punks. I was from Generation Annihilation, and I really didn't care about the world. And that's not really why I do what I do. I just happen to be good at it, and I have a lot of fun being the best that I can be in the trade of my choice. And I'm not going to apologize for being myself. I'm sorry if that hurts your feelings, but I'm not going to apologize for being myself. So what ended up happening is I stopped going to meetings. And I was living in, I spent most of the time of a 3-year period between the ages of 10 and 13 or 14 years sober, and stopped going to meetings, collecting guns, and living in oil camps. Now, I spent enough time living in psychiatric facilities that I know how to conduct myself in isolated communities. So, bottom line is I got really sick, okay? I got really sick, stopped going to meetings, didn't have any friends in AA. You know what I mean? And I mean, that's a bit of a harsh statement, right? But I'd grown distant. You know, it brought me to a whole new place of isolation, loneliness, despair, and depression. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, like, I mean, I know death's a pretty black and white subject, but there are worse fates than death. And it brought me to a whole new level of emotional pain that I never knew existed. So what ended up happening is I moved back. I moved in with the only friend that I had kept in contact with, who was a convicted unrepentant felon. And he'd been sober in AA 10 years previous and was not sober now. He was in his active addiction, and I moved in with him. And I was doing some, I set up my welding machine. I had a little workshop there. I was doing all sorts of crazy custom stuff on my motorcycle. And what ended up happening was he got really jealous, and he couldn't handle me being cooler than him. And one time he threatened to take my life when I was asleep. And, when I was a homeless kid on the street and stuff, all I really had was my word. So if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it, right? It's just a level of commitment and integrity that the 12 steps have brought me to. So I was faced with the decision, and what ended up happening was I had tied a noose and hung it in my shed. And I hung it in the shed, and the only place where I could hang it from the rafters was right in front of a picture, a huge poster, a huge full-color poster of Golden Siddhartha. And that's the only place where I could hang the noose. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, that is ironic. Just around that painful time in my sobriety, I was confronted by a beautiful young woman that started asking me some very serious personal spiritual questions about my program in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized that I was at a crossroads. I could either put 30 bullets in this guy's head, I could go into my shed and hang myself with that noose, or I could answer this young girl's questions. Because this young, you know, it's like, you know, we get sober and we're sober for long periods of time, and it's not always happy, joyous, and free all the time. We don't all live happily ever after. People go out after 7, 10, 12 years. So what I did is I started going to meetings again, and there's some people that took me under their wing and welcomed me back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a GSR position, I got a home group, I got a sponsor, I started working the steps again so I could answer this young girl's questions. Now, you know, I don't really like to spell it out for people, right? What I like to do is I like to give people the opportunity to develop the dignity to figure it out themselves. When I was a young boy, and I was struggling with my sexuality, I used to play cards with my grandmother. My Nana Ruby was a very special person, so we played lots of cards. When I got into punk rock, you know, she sort of like was not too, you know, she grew up in a town where the population is still 300 people, and I grew into punk rock and I got into drinking and stuff, and I grew away from her. You know, and family didn't really want to have too much to do with me. But I really liked when she came over to play cards with me because I could steal 20s out of her wallet. So that went on for a few years. Now, here we come around. You know, I'm like a year or two sober. She passes on. I get asked to give the eulogy at her funeral. So I said nothing but nice things about her. She was a wonderful woman. I still love her dearly to this day. But what ended up happening as a result of living the steps outside of the rooms in the real world, because as far as I'm concerned, it's easy to be a spiritual person sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a tremendous reputation outside in the real world where I spend 80% of my life. And the people in the real world treat me the same way that you people treat me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm the same transparent personality wherever I go. I don't have to put on a show. I don't have to put on a front. I don't have to put on a facade or an act. I'm just myself. Right? So what ended up happening was, as a result, I go on lots of road trips on my motorcycle. I string a tarp off it, like an A-frame on the side of it. I camp on my road trips and stuff all over the United States and Canada. I travel by myself and I have lots of fun, and I go to custom motorcycle shops and I visit lots of friends and stuff. And every time I'm passing through Alberta, I go through this tiny little town with 300 people. I visit my grandmother's grave. I bring a little change purse from the dollar store with a 20 in it and leave it on her grave, you know, because I just want, you know, it's out of my control is what happens to it. I just want her to know that I still love her and I still pray about her and I still love her very much. What happened was when I was on a road trip, I was going to Alaska. And what happened was I was on the Alaska Highway, and it was, it's so far north, there's not much darkness, right? It's like it starts to get dark at 11 o'clock at night, and it starts to get light again at 3 o'clock in the morning, but it's never dark, it's just dusk, and that's when the animals come out. So I'm cruising along on my chopper, and I seen this dark, shadowy figure sort of like sauntering along the side of the road, and I was like, whoa, dude, that's like super close. And what ended up happening was I just sort of passed it and I looked, and it was a black bear. And it was like, it was bigger than a person, but it had sort of like a long back. And I was just like a little bit nervous, but, you know, just very intuitive. What ended up happening is it started chasing after me on my bike, and it jumped. And what it did is it swiped its claw and tried to grab my face and knock me off my bike. But I could see how long its claws were, as long as my fingers. And I was like shocked at what was happening. So what I did is I slammed on my brakes, and the bear landed in front of me, right in front of the headlight, and then it just sauntered off into the wilderness like nothing ever happened. Now, I'm not here to brag about how great I want you to think I am, or how good I want you to think my program is. You know, I'm just here because I'm a trusted servant. But the bottom line is that from working the steps, we live in God's world, and God's world is way bigger than the world inside my head. And anything can happen in God's world. You know, I've seen wonderful successes and amazing people that have touched my soul and changed my life because they've been doing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thanks for asking me to speak.
Thank you, Rob. The WACUPA 15 host committee would like to thank all of the conference participants and attendees for making this weekend possible and magical. The next panel meeting in this room will begin at never, and the topic is nothing. I believe that there won't be another meeting until after the main meeting. Please help me thank our speakers and reader again. And after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers, Tom, will you lead us out in the prayer of your choice?